The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Football Weekly.
Hoorah! It's internationals. England, Spain, the Spanish side picked apart for us by Sid Lowe, the only Englishman who'll do that this weekend, while Barry and Jaro brain Jonathan Wilson tackled Poppygate, a battle more over the top than some of those it supposedly commemorates. Elsewhere, playoff drama ahoy! Tallinn Tales of Ireland, Estonia, plus actual broadcaster Pedro Pinto joins us to talk about Portugal and their extraordinary dramatic clash with B&H. There's Newcastle Stadium naming rights, posts and Italy. Unlucky Luciano as Juve's director general gets a 5-year, 4-month jail sentence in the big finale of the Calciopoli trial. Will he ever serve it? Stay tuned to find out the answer to that and more in Extra Money Please Football Weekly, formerly Football Weekly Extra. Hoo boy, quite literally, Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Barry Glendenning.
Hi, James.
And get this, Jonathan Wilson.
Hi, James.
So many things to discuss. The big England-Spain game coming up. Is everybody high or what? What is the story with this Poppygate business, Barry?
Well, it's an ongoing saga that would suggest a lot of people in the UK have, I don't know, eaten or drank something that's made them go mentally wrong in the head.
Mm.
It's been quite extraordinary and slightly depressing, to be honest, and embarrassing.
Mm.
And all concerned should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves, including the FA, assorted fans and assorted journalists and media outlets.
Jonathan, lay the stat on us.
Yeah, this will be the 37th time that England have played between the 1st and the 15th of November since the end of the First World War. And in none of the 36 previous occasions have they felt the need to make a kit of a poppy.
Until now, FIFA have never allowed us to play with a poppy armband. It's disgraceful.
Well, that's one we're looking at.
No, it is extraordinary. And so the whole thing's basically been drummed up now, almost as if there was something else they didn't want us to be thinking about.
Possibly. I mean, there are times, though, when the nation just goes doolally. It happened over Princess Diana, when suddenly you thought, you know, is this the Britain I know and grown up with? But the other thing I think to say is that...
The answer to that is yes.
Well, quite probably. But I think it's, you know, important. If people want to, you know, remember those that have fallen, that's great, and they should do so. Blazing it on a black armband...
I've got no objections, you know, to that, but...
I just think it's... Yeah.
Well, in many ways, the armband is better than the shirt, because the shirt, if you're a player, you have to wear that.
Mm.
Whereas you do, I mean, you actually don't have a choice because of the pressure that's on them.
Mm.
But theoretically, the armband gives you a choice.
Mm.
And even, you know, even the British Legion said yesterday, it should be about choice. That's the very liberty that people were fighting for in the Second World War. And, you know, they seem to have come out of this with a reputation enhanced because they've actually talked sense about it. And it's not that FIFA have stopped England from remembering or making a show of remembering. They're allowing poppies on the training tops. They're allowing a minute's silence. They're allowing the armbands even before they agreed to allow the poppies on it. But FIFA have a very sensible regulation that says you can't have political or commercial emblems on the shirts. Now, the reason that's there is that if England is allowed to remember its war dead, you're on the shirt, then every nation logically is. So what if Serbia suddenly say, OK, on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, which we see as the founding date of our nation, we want to wear the Serbian emblem of the three-fingered salute on our shirt. Would we be happy with that? And if we're not happy with that, how can we demand to be allowed to remember our war dead in our particular way?
It's all about personal choice.
It is. And there are a billion different ways of remembering, a lot of which are a lot more effective, although the publicity from all of this has been extremely useful to the Royal British Legion, and that's a very positive side of this. But why it had to all become about a shirt and why it was absolutely vital that FIFA understands Britain's view, as Cameron put it. Lord only knows. Anyway.
It's almost as if Cameron wanted to deflect attention away from maybe his defence minister or Home Secretary.
And the defence minister.
Yeah.
All of them.
And the FA deflecting attention away from John Terry.
Well, of almost secondary importance amongst all of this is the fact that England are playing a friendly with Spain, a world champions Spain. Rob Walcarew posts in for Jonathan Wilson. If you were in charge of England, Jonathan, what tactics would you use? And who would you select that aren't among Capello's favourites?
I think it probably is the 4-3-3-1 that Capello is using, purely because I think the balance of that works with the side he's got, and that it's not reliant on any one player being available or not available, which is always a problem at international level. In terms of who I would... Well, I mean, Micah Richards, I think, is an obvious one. It's very odd that he's not in the side. Even if you question his defensive ability, he's so good getting forward that it's easy enough for somebody playing defensive midfield on the right side to cover him, you'd have thought.
And also, if you question his defensive ability, why would you call up Glenn Johnson in his place?
Absolutely, yeah.
Beyond Micah Richards, anybody else that you reckon should be...?
Not really. No? I mean, Capello, I think, gets a lot of grief. You know, after the World Cup, there was all this thing about, oh, he's got to bring in the young players. Well, he has brought in young players, but he's staggered it. He hasn't just sort of blooded them all. Because, to put them all in together, how are they supposed to fit into the international system? It has to be a process of evolution. I think Capello's actually managed that reasonably well, given the circumstances, which for international managers are never easy. And to be honest, it's all irrelevant until a month before the tournament anyway, when you find out who you've got available. And the business of preparing for the tournament really begins then. These friendlies, apart from making money for the FA, the makeup of the side and the squad for this friendly is likely to be so different to that next summer. The people in form and out of form is likely to be so different. It has little relevance to the tournament.
You see, I disagree with that, because I think if you look at 2010, the two best teams in the world got to the final, Spain and Holland, that had a long unbeaten run, both in competitive matches and friendlies. Ditto 2006, Italy created that momentum by winning lots of friendly matches against the very best team. So I think it's important that England are up against the likes of Spain, likes against the other side, so they could meet next summer. And I think even if Spain play their second string side, I think they will... They should beat England, and we'll provide a real test at Wembley.
Is there also a value to actually trying out a team over the next couple of matches without Wayne Rooney in it, given that at least two games, depending on this appeal that they're launching?
Yeah, logically there ought to be, but the problem is that we know that five or six of the players you play on Saturday are likely to be unavailable next summer, and that's the huge problem all international managers have. The one thing that I would really criticise Capello for is the two friendlies before the World Cup, the games against Mexico at Wembley and the game against Japan in Austria, I think it was. That's when you should start playing the team that you will use in the first game of the World Cup. And if you have doubts as to do we play player A or player B in this position, that's when you should give him a chance. But the thing that I just didn't understand then was he gave Darren Bent 45 minutes, he gave Tom Huddleston 45 minutes. Now, either you think those players aren't good enough, in which case just ignore them, or you give them a proper chance to prove themselves, which means playing for at least 70, 75 minutes. Mm. Everybody knows that in one half, especially a centre-forward, if he doesn't get a chance given to him, provided for him, well, he's anonymous. He has no opportunity to prove himself. So those two games, I thought the selection was very, very odd. But apart from that, I struggle to understand the criticism of Capello.
I normally think friendlies are a complete waste of time, but I think this particular one is a sort of a notch above friendly. Just, it's going to be a full house. People seem to think it's a genuine test for England to see how good they are. But I think perhaps a draw would be the best result for them. If they win, they'll lose the run of themselves altogether. And if they lose, and lose heavily, which is very possible, that could be a huge blow to their confidence. So I think it is more important than the sort of run-of-the-mill friendly, which is of no importance at all, usually.
Well, Barry and I were talking about this because there was money involved, and Spain were betting than even money to win at Wembley early this week. And I sort of told Barry that I'd lumped on, because I think even though they play the second string side, they'll still have Martinez, Fabregas, Cazorla in midfield, and probably Mata, Torres, Silva up front. I mean, that's an incredibly strong lineup. So I think Spain, I know they lost to Argentina and Portugal in friendlies last year, but I think they'll be up for this at Wembley, and I think whatever team they put out, they'll be a stronger team later. And I think even money, or around even money, is a fantastic price.
I'm genuinely staggered by that. I'd have thought there'd have been comfortable odds on.
William Hill's had them at 6-5 earlier this week, and now you can get them even.
Without wishing to turn this into kind of a tipping thing, all four South American World Cup qualifiers on Friday, I'd say lay the home team. They all look massively short to me. Bolivia are tens to draw against Argentina.
Spain, meantime, the man to tell us a little bit more about what kind of first string, second string, etc. lineup they'll be fielding against England and whether our brave boys have any chance at all is Sid Lowe, live from the Spanish Football Federation. Have you just won an award?
No, I haven't won an award, but I have been given a nice little box thing, set thing, which has got five prints in it of paintings of Spain's five most important goals in history.
Right.
It's been part of this big, long event that's has been happening this morning at Spain HQ.
So do you have to kiss any frogs to get those prints, Sid?
Hey, very good. I don't think I've ever kissed a frog.
All right. Spain, Sid, Spain. We were just talking about their upcoming clash with England at Wembley. What kind of team are they going to send?
The squad is almost entirely as we expected. A couple of very slight surprises, maybe the inclusion of Nacho Monreal and Jesus Navas. And I think the team will be a really, really strong one as well. Maybe one or two little bits of tinkering with it, but I think that they'll play pretty much their strongest side at Wembley and then maybe a slightly weakened side 3 or 4 days late when they travel to Costa Rica.
Spain haven't done very well in friendlies recently, Sid. Any chance of England continuing that record?
Well, I suppose there is a chance. Spain were awful when they were beaten by Portugal, when they were beaten by Argentina, but they did beat Chile, even though they started really, really badly in Zurich, I think it was, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And they did come back from that to win 3-2. I think this is the kind of game where they, in theory at least, shouldn't fall into quite that trap because I think it will be taken a bit more seriously. I think while we like to see it as a cliche, the whole Wembley thing does matter. I think historically, emotionally, that does matter to Spanish players. So that may well make a difference. And also because of the sense that it's building up now. But, of course, it is true that for a lot of Spanish national team players, this is a problem now, having the international break, rather than a good thing.
Basically, I'm wondering, how up for this game do you think Spain will be? They're a very generous, better than even money to win it with the bookies. Mm. So are they worth having a punt on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it won't be a problem of motivation. I mean, obviously there will be perhaps a slightly less motivation than for a normal competitive game. But I think that Wembley matters, England matter. This is being taken seriously. Spain will play with their strongest side. I think in that sense that they probably are worth a punt. And of course, if they get it right, the bottom line is they're the better side.
No arguments there.
I'm just intrigued by what five goals you've got in your print. Is one of them against England in 1929?
Oh, look at that man in the middle. That's pretty impressive. The other four, obviously, 64, Marcelino, Andres Iniesta, 2010, Fernando Torres, 2008, and then the other one's 1992, the Kiko goal even, that won them the Olympic gold medal in Barcelona.
That's the one I wouldn't have got.
Marvellous.
I'm amazed you got the first one. That's the one I'm impressed with.
Tell us about the first one, Jonathan.
It was England's first ever defeat to the Johnny Foreigner.
Right.
They went down 4-3 in Spain. And it was crowd trouble. There was guards with swords out. It was all very exciting. If you read my last book, The Anatomy of England, the first chapter is all about that, which Sid was very helpful in tracking down newspaper cuttings and things from.
They've just bought a really nice, big-looking plate of ham, James, so I'm a happy man.
All right, excellent. So you're going to have a big plate of ham at the Federation. This is for all the journalists, is it, or just you?
Well, it's for everybody who's at the event, because they've been presented with the new shirt today. The four players who've got over 100 caps have been given a UEFA cap award. Oh. By the way, there's five for England, four for Spain. One of them wasn't here. Raul hasn't been able to make it from Germany. There's also an award for Xavi Hernandez, who's the latest player to go over 100 caps. So there's a whole load of people here, sponsors, people from the Federation, obviously players, and loads of journalists too.
All right, excellent. Well, listen, fill your boots, and we'll catch up with you, I hope, on Monday.
Fantastic. Speak to you then.
Thanks, Sid. Sid Lowe in Spain. Well, loads more still to come in this Football Weekly Extra. We've got Pedro Pinto on the line from Portugal very, very shortly. We'll be looking through all those Euro 2012 playoff clashes and much, much more after this. Part two. And now things get serious because it's playoff time. Eight teams trying to fight their way through to Euro 2012. The matchups: Bosnia-Herzegovina against Portugal, Turkey, Croatia, Czech Republic against Montenegro, and Estonia hosting Trapattoni's Republic of Ireland. Don't say cat unless you have it in the sack, as Trapattoni would put it himself. I'm not sure there's much we can add to that, is there?
Well, Trapattoni during the week went on a very long feline analogy about cats in sacks.
Yeah, it's an Italian thing.
Nobody had the foggiest idea what he was talking about.
Right. Don't count your chickens until they're hatched is the idiom.
Oh, right,
more
okay.
Common in this part of the world.
Well, I don't think anyone is counting chickens.
No. I mean, I don't know if that's something we
used
to do a lot.
Or putting cats in sacks.
Yeah. Don't count on the cat until you got it in the sack. When was that a common thing that people used to do in Italy? Go around bagging cats? I don't know.
You're the Italian expert. I've wrapped cats.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, in your veterinary days?
Yeah, well, they have quite sharp claws, as you may know. And if a cat needs to get an injection or something, the best way to stop it from scratching you to ribbons is to wrap it in a blanket.
Right. Does that apply to bears as well or not?
You would need a very big...
big blanket.
Speaking of bears, actually, have you been watching Frozen Planet?
I haven't been watching
Frozen
Planet.
It is sensational television.
All right, then.
I think a lot of people, just judging from Twitter, a lot of people who are mad into football have been switching off the last 20 minutes of Champions League games to turn over to Frozen Planet.
All right, then.
Anyway, Estonia v Ireland. I don't think anyone in Ireland is counting their chickens. Ireland got the draw they wanted, Estonia got the draw they wanted. So, you know, it's two teams playing each other. They're both quite content to be playing each other. Ireland probably should win, but may not. You know, Estonia are a fledgling nation as far as international football is concerned. A lot of people in Estonia didn't really like football to begin with because it was always considered a Russian game and they didn't like the Russians.
Have they been won over by Trapattoni's Republic of Ireland?
I think as a result of watching... Trapattoni's Republic of Ireland, they have been won over, all right, yeah. Who wouldn't be? So, yeah, if Ireland do qualify, no doubt we'll go to the European Championships and stink the place up, but we could win like Greece did.
It's the first time in 10 years, if you go, that you'll have been to be going to an international tournament. Sean?
Well, it's interesting looking at Ireland's, and they're unbeaten in 9 international matches, which is pretty decent. I mean, I guess the worry for Ireland is with Shane Long out and Kevin Doyle suspended for the first leg, it might even be even more tedious and dull than usual.
Well, that's a very good question. You know, one goal conceded in those 9 games. It's pretty extraordinary. But yes, no Shane Long, no Doyle. And is Robbie Keane, is he fit?
Robbie Keane is fit and on a scoring streak of one match. He scored for LA Galaxy in their magnificent victory over the New York Red Bulls in the MLS playoffs, as I'm sure you know, late last week.
Mm-hmm.
So... the only thing, he should be fine.
I was going to ask Jonathan what he thinks of Estonia. Obviously, they've won the last 3. They've beaten Northern Ireland twice and beaten Slovenia. Do you think they can cause a surprise here?
They really oughtn't to. But I mean, I think the best you can say of Estonia is that they're good enough to take advantage if the opposition lets them. And that's how they got through the group. I mean, Serbia really underperformed. Slovenia underperformed. Northern Ireland managed to lose twice to them in the last 3 fixtures. And I think all of those 3 sides... you would expect to be better than Estonia. And you know, as Barry says, it's really, football's a new sport in Estonia. It's really only the last 20 years they've begun to take it seriously.
Basketball is their main sport. Is
basketball and cross-country skiing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, another particularly interesting matchup in the playoff fixture list is, of course, Portugal's clash with Bosnia-Herzegovina. To tell us more about that and the state of play with the Portuguese, CNN's Pedro Pinto now joins us. Hello, Pedro. We were just discussing the Trapattoni's use of Italian idiom, specifically, don't say cat until you have it in the sack. What's the Portuguese equivalent of that?
Just very, very basic of don't put the cart in front of the
horse.
Of the horse, or don't count the chickens. You know, we do have those basic farm analogies like I think you have here.
All right. Well, yeah, now you can bring this cat sack business in and expand everyone's horizons. There you go. Listen, thanks very much for joining us today. Big series of matches coming up for Portugal. Is there a lot of optimism about this playoff?
I would say optimism more than confidence. I think everybody realizes that it would be a disaster for Portugal not to qualify for next year's European Championships. At the same time, everyone's aware that Bosnia is a very, very tough adversary, considering we only beat them 1-0 in both legs of a World Cup playoff. And the fact that this team is a little bit in turmoil at the moment. You know, Ricardo Carvalho walked out of a training center. You've got Bozingua now saying he'll never play for the national team again, while the manager, Paulo Bento, is still there. You've got the federation complaining about the pitch, saying it's like a potato field. So we could have a more serene and confident build-up to this game than what's going on right now.
Mm. It looked like things were going to be a bit calmer with that great run of results. Was it five straight victories that Paulo Bento had?
Exactly.
And then everything went wrong with the defeat in Denmark, which then prompted Carlos Queiroz to pop up and say that he should be doing the job instead of Bento.
Yeah, because he did so well.
Exactly, yeah. Curious that. But and a lot of the press, and particularly the foreign press, seemed to be blaming the Portuguese defeat in Denmark on Cristiano Ronaldo and his extraordinarily selfish play. Was that a view matched in Portugal?
Look, I think the issue is he did have a poor game. The only thing he did was score that free kick in injury time. The problem is that he feels too much pressure when he plays for Portugal. There's no doubt about that. He thinks he needs to pick up the ball in midfield, take it forward, dribble it past three or four guys and score every time he gets it, because I don't think he's that confident in the other players that are up front. Nani is the only other world-class player we have up there right now. There's no world-class center forward. We don't have a pure number 10, which is very worrying for a country like Portugal, who had the likes of Rui Costa, and then we had to get Deco, the Brazilian. Hugo Viana, who I know you know well from his time at Newcastle, he hasn't really fulfilled his promise. Carlos Martins hasn't fulfilled his promise. So I think it's either Ronaldo, when he gets the ball, he looks up and sees, where's Nani? Okay, I can't pass it to him right now, so I'm going to put my head down and try to dribble past three or four guys. He's just trying too hard and trying to do too much, James.
And what about at the back, Pedro, with Abusingwa and of course, Carvalho, who left some time ago, are there adequate replacements?
Look, it's a tough situation in defense right now. Carvalho is the player who is most missed. He may be 33 years old, but Pep, I'm sure you've seen some of his antics at Real Madrid. He is susceptible to having the wild streak. He needs someone calm around him, and that's not Bruno Alves, who's known for being a bit of a ruffian as well. On the right, it is a little bit of an issue. There aren't many options right now. The third string has been brought in because Silvio can't play either. The Atletico Madrid right back can also play on the left. But Fabio Coentrão, definitely the best player we have at the back right now. Again, better at attacking than defending. So that is still the main worry, is that the spine of the team, central defense, central midfield, and center forward, really is not inspiring the kind of confidence and doesn't have the kind of quality that it did when Portugal made the final of Euro 2004 and when they had the great run to the semi-finals of the World Cup in 2006.
What a record Portugal has. Lastly then, what would it mean to the country were you to miss out on Euro 2012?
There's two schools of thought here. The first one is that it's a disaster, because this is a country that has some of the brightest football talents on the planet. They're playing at the top clubs in the world, and this is unacceptable. The other school of thought is, right now, all of the top clubs in the Portuguese league don't have Portuguese players. They're all South American. And it needs to get to a point where people realize that there is no further generation that's coming through. And maybe this would be a big wake-up call for everyone to say, what's going on here? What can be done to change it? Mm. Being born and raised in Portugal, even though I've lived abroad a long time, I can't imagine Portugal not qualifying. It would be horrible for everyone there, especially with the financial crisis going there. Be horrible for the self-esteem. But if that happens, then all I hope is that people at least take it as a big alarm call to change the ways and to give chances to Portuguese youngsters that are really not getting a look in it at Portuguese clubs.
All right. Pedro, listen, best of luck then. And perhaps we'll speak to you again soon after the outcome of said playoffs.
And I hope it's a positive one.
Well, indeed.
Thank you, James.
Thank you very much.
Some of our listeners may not be familiar with Pedro's work. He presents the Champions League draw every year with a very attractive lady whose name escapes me. But he's all teeth and hair. He's a very handsome television presenter.
He's got a lovely
man.
Voice as well.
And he's got a lovely syrupy honey voice.
Right.
I was going to ask Jonathan what he makes of Bosnia's chances. I mean, they're unbeaten in the last six. They seem to be stronger now than they were 2 years ago, and they're playing a Portugal side that, as Pedro says, aren't as cohesive as they were.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Ciro Blažević left after they lost in the playoff last time, I think a lot of people, and myself included, you know, we thought that was it. We thought they'd basically been carried along by Ciro's charisma. And when that went, you know, the air would go out of the balloon. Actually, Safer Susic has come in, and I think he's made them a better side. They're a more cohesive side. I think they're a side that plays less on nervous energy. I think the move to a back four really suits them. I was at the game in Paris when they drew 1-1, and they were absolutely superb the first hour of that game. Then I don't know if they ran out of legs or if psychologically knowing they were that close to the first qualification, whether that got to them. And I think that in many ways is the worry, that they were 11 minutes from qualifying. Can they pick themselves up to go again? And I know that there's a great sense of frustration about the last playoff, that they played very, very well in Lisbon, lost 1-0 there. I think they hit the woodwork twice in that game. And people thought, OK, only one goal down, we go back to Zenit, so it's a real small, tight stadium, a real bear pit of an atmosphere. And they just didn't turn up for that game. It was a very, very flat atmosphere. They never quite got going. And I think having the first leg in Zenit this time, although most people say they prefer the home leg second, I think it really might help them that they can try and get a lead on the board. They can hammer Portugal from the first minute. And I think they're a better side now than they were 2 years ago. I don't think Portugal is as good as they were 2 years ago. And they were very, very close in Lisbon last time. So I think they do have a good chance. The problem for Bosnia is that three of their first-choice back four won't be playing. The right-back is Muja is injured. He'll miss both legs. And the two centre-backs, they're both suspended for the first leg. So that's a big problem.
All right. The Czech Republic are going to be taking on Montenegro, plucky Montenegro, population of six, isn't it? And a couple of cats in bags, I'm not sure.
I mean, that's a strange one, though, isn't it? I mean, Montenegro haven't won in five. They, you know, we sort of, you know, gave them an awful lot of credit when they started off the group, and they seem to be off the ball. The Czech Republic, probably the worst Czech side in 25, 30 years,
yeah,
easily.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they struggled through qualifying. Kladić is their top scorer at four, I think, and three of those were penalties. I mean, doesn't seem to be much.
No, I mean, Montenegro are very hard to judge as well, because, you know, the good results they had under Zlatko Kranjčar, they were then sort of undermined. They had a run of three games where they didn't win under Kranjčar, which, to be fair, was at least partly down to injuries. I mean, they went into that game in Wales without any of their first-choice back four. Kranjčar then gets sacked after the defeat there. It just doesn't make sense that he should go if it's about results, because he'd still put them in a position where they were almost certain to get in the playoffs. And I think he deserved the chance to lead Montenegro into the playoffs. And we don't really know how the squad's adapted to Brnovic taking over, because they played two games, played a game against England where they were awful in the first half, 2-0 down, but then very, very good in the second half. And then a game in Switzerland where they went in without Vucinic and without Jovetic, who got themselves booked late on in the England game, so they were suspended for that match so they'd be free for the playoffs. And it was a dead rubber game anyway. So very hard to judge those two matches. And I think a lot depends on what the morale's like after the change of coach.
Meanwhile, Turkey-Croatia, Slaven Bilic, Gus Hiddink, ahoy. Which is the game you're going to tune into this weekend?
Bosnia-Portugal.
Right, okay.
Well, Turkey-Croatia is obviously a repeat of the fantastic game in Euro 2008, which Turkey won on penalties. Croatia had all but won in the dying moments, and Turkey had a late equaliser. We were watching it.
I'm surprised you remember it at all.
Beer clinic. Yeah. I remember a few bits about that. And
was that the extraordinary game where the Turkish goalkeeper ran out to the corner flag just as the forwards were bearing down on his goal, then he had to scramble merrily back again?
And Klaasen just glanced in the head of the empty net,
yeah.
I don't remember that bit.
Right. That was a Croatian goal, which is on 119 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yes. And then Turkey equalised.
Sintek scored in the 122nd minute.
And while this was going on, I'd left the windows open during the biggest rainstorm in Central Europe.
And we went back to our apartment and all the windows were smashed.
Right.
And the Boney M pictures on the wall, hundreds of them, were all
signed originals.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel awful about that.
The lies we had to tell to the guy who owned the apartment when he came back, that poor man.
Yeah. Anyway, Turkey-Croatia playing again then. Well, that sounds exciting.
Don't forget to close your windows.
Yeah. Croatia, are they any good, Croatia, these days?
No.
Okay.
I saw them in Greece. They were absolutely dismal. I think that game in 2008, for both sides, they grasped at something that, you know, at a glory that looked quite close. And for Croatia, it's been downhill ever since. I think Turkey got through to the semi, and then they didn't kick on from there. The momentum didn't carry them to the World Cup. They failed to qualify, and they haven't really been particularly impressive in qualifying. So I think it's two sides who potentially could be very good, but are both struggling for consistency.
You'd still have to fancy Croatia over the players that they have, surely. I mean, Eduardo scored a few goals. He seems to be a little bit more back in form.
He's nowhere near the player he was, so Kranjčar's out.
Modric?
Yeah, Modric will play, but he has to play a little bit deeper because, you know, 4 years ago, they've had Niko Kovac. I think they really miss him. The Vukojevic is perfectly adequate to sit in front of the back four. He doesn't have the same passing ability that Kovac has, so Modric has to play deeper. I think Bilic possibly has been in the job too long. I mean, he'll have, if he takes him to the Euros, he'll have been there for 6 years for, you know, three campaigns, and you've got a real sense of a jaded side. And I think the relationship between Bilic and the Croatian media is quite tense now. There was all kinds of revelations about his private life that he reacted badly to. You know, he's not as friendly with the Croatian media as he was, and I think that causes tension. To be fair, in Greece, they needed a draw effectively to secure a top spot in the group, and that, I guess, it means your mentality is a bit different. And they did look comfortable until the 70th minute, and they then let in two soft goals from dead balls. It was a bit of an odd game because of the crowd trouble that meant the game was delayed, and that sort of took a bit of a life out of the first half. So, I mean, there possibly are extenuating circumstances for why they were so flat in that match, but they didn't look the vibrant side we remember from 2008.
All right, well, they've won 7 of their 10 qualifiers.
It's an easy group, though, isn't it? It's a pathetically easy group.
I mean, Turkey have won 6 of their last 7 competitive home games,
really?
But the opposition haven't been up to much, really. The toughest game they had was against Germany, and they got beaten in that.
Yeah.
I mean, Bilic around Euro 2008, after Croatia qualified at England's expense and was the only show in town, and he was being linked with jobs all over the place. Do you think maybe he's missed the boat now? And
well, possibly, but I mean, in many ways, it's good for him. He felt it his patriotic duty to be his national manager for not a huge amount of money. I mean, that is the concern for him, but I don't think he's a worse manager now than he was then. I think it's just that if you're a manager of a small nation like Croatia, you lose something like Niko Kovac, it's very hard to find a replacement. Eduardo, who was scoring hatfuls of goals, then he breaks his leg. I mean, he missed the Euros, which I think people tend to forget. They had to change their shape because of that. But you lose that potency, that it's very hard to replace him. So, you know, it's natural with something like Croatia. You have these cycles according to whether you have the players or whether you don't.
Well, that's how things look before the first leg of these playoffs then. And we'll, of course, update you on how they turn out, as if you didn't know already, on Monday. That's it for part two. In part three, a bit of a mixed bag of miscellanea. With a bit of Modgy, a bit of Mike Ashley, other things too. Part three begins with a bit of listener input, specifically listeners like Grot and Patrick Call and Irish Rover 83, who were perturbed by our pro Steve Keane comments in Monday's pod. Patrick Call, among his points, saying Steve Keane's out of his depth, etc., and asking a question about Venky's and the role of Miles Anderson, whose son Blackburn Rovers is Jerome Anderson, is it? Whose son Steve Keane signed, but who I think has never played for Blackburn Rovers, is that right?
Yeah, I think there's all kinds of questions being asked about conflicts of interest. But Jerome Anderson has, you know, his ties with Blackburn have been severed, I think, 2 or 3 months ago. There's still a question over who's in charge of transfer policy. And my understanding is that it's somebody fairly young and inexperienced who's still based in India.
Oh, good. Well, anyway, Patrick was saying the main problem, though, is the amount of games that Steve Keane has won, and that's what makes people protest. Irish River 83, Keane's record since he became team manager is atrocious. These owners have misled supporters every turn, show no sign of heeding the increasingly vocal calls for action on their part. I mean, basically, they're saying that it was a little bit patronising for us to say, yeah, you should be happy with Steve Keane, because it's really not a very happy boat there.
I think the thing with Steve Keane as well is that within the game, I'm not saying it's universal, but certainly there's a sense that, you know, he didn't act as honourably as he might have done when it came to Sam Allardyce's departure. I think there's sort of a resentment there among other managers. So whether that affects relationships when you're trying to do transfers and things, I'm not sure.
The other thing I think is worth pointing out that Keane seems to be almost replicating the avant-garde model from last season. He has, you know, a cup run, the odd half-decent result, half-decent performance. But the fact remains, you know, Blackburn are struggling just like West Ham did all of last season.
Yes, indeed. Up Your Arsenal says, with Fergie's 25th anniversary, a lot was made of how many people who've either worked or played under him there are in the game. Even in the Premiership alone, there are 2, Steve Bruce and Alex McLeish. Same is true for Mourinho, who worked with both Brendan Rodgers and Andre Villas-Boas. Why does the pod think there are no ex-Wenger players who manage in the top league? Formica Atomica contributes 1. Do you know who that is, anyone?
Well, you've got the Lyon manager.
Yeah, good.
Remy Gard.
Yeah, very good, Sean Ingle. Slasher says, on Thursday, get Jonathan Wilson to talk about the latest scandal to rock Russian football. Last Friday, things kicked off at a reserve match played in Grozny between Terek and FC Krasnodar. Yeah, with the visitors 3-0 up, their captain Spartak Godniev was sent off with 18 minutes to go. In the aftermath of the sending off, he was attacked by fans and officials. His teammates left the pitch in protest, and he was also battered and taken away by the police, suffering a concussion, a broken nose, and two broken ribs. What's this about, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, that pretty much sums it up. That's what happened, apparently.
So the police beat up the
reserve team captain, yeah.
Wow.
And presumably the Russian Football Union will finally be forced to act. I mean, there's been various suggestions in Grozny before that there's been intimidation of particularly match officials, and nothing really has been done. But this obviously is a bit more serious than previous instances.
Slasher also talking about Mr. Kadyrov. Is he the owner of?
Well, he's the president of Chechnya, and he's also the owner of the club.
Right. And top friend of Hilary Swank, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Seal and Vanessa May. And turned up for various birthday parties.
A whole host of players who turned up for various charity games.
Hmm. Well, thanks for that, Slasher. Do you have much hope of anything happening about this or not?
I don't know. I think it is so serious and it's created such an outcry that possibly something will have to be done, but I wouldn't bank on it.
Hmm. Somebody else asked, what happened to the poor bloke who lost his hearing in one ear after being smacked in that petrolul... who was Petrol? Was it Steaua Bucharest?
Yeah, he's a Steaua player. As far as I'm aware, he's still deaf in that ear, and the zygomatic bone.
Right.
He's waiting for that to heal.
Right. And what's happened to the fan who was allowed to run on and do this?
As far as I'm aware, nothing is yet. But I mean, clearly there will be assault proceedings against him.
Right. Very good. Italy. Let's see. Mr. Gareth E says, beautiful sweeping under the carpet from AC Jimbo in your podcast. Actual match fixing only results in 6 points off your current total and that's it. Well, no, Mr. Gareth E, because what I said at the time was, I think we're going to see some jail time handed out when the verdict in the Calciopoli trial comes in. It might be this week. And lo and behold, about the next day, down in Naples, the police trial, the kind of criminal trial, finally came to an end after 2 years. And boy, did they hand out some verdicts. Did you see these, Barry?
Yes.
Luciano Moggi, 5 years and 4 months of jail time.
And what prison is he in?
Well, obviously, you're not guilty until you're proven guilty and then had your appeal, etc., etc., etc. So, well, there is a slight kind of coda on this, which is that...
So he's not in
prison.
He's
not in jail at the moment, which, as we said last time, that there might be an issue about him actually serving time. But it might happen. Basically, they have 90 days... for the court to explain its verdict, to give the motivation, as it's known. Once that is in, and that takes 90 days to do, then they'll all launch appeals. But as it stands, he is set to serve a sentence of over 5 years. He's also got a 3-year ban from attending any sporting event or arena, which is pretty interesting. It was interesting, in Ibrahimovic's autobiography, Eyes Latan, yeah, he talks about when Moggi, when the scandal first broke in 2006, and there was this man who had always seemed so important with his big cigar, just standing broken in tears in front of him. And I actually, that's an image I treasure. Can I say that's an image I treasure? Anyway, Juve have washed their hands of Moggi. Moggi is now launching attacks on Juve, saying, how can they say they didn't know? I was their director general. They bought all the dodgy phone cards for the referees to use to contact me. And other people who've been caught up in all this and received sentences include the presidents of Fiorentina and Regina, and also Lazio, Claudio Lotito, who've all been banned from holding any kind of sporting office. That means Lotito can no longer be on the kind of federal council of Italian football. So this is huge stuff. Anyway, there you go. Huge stuff greeted by a yawn from Sean Ingle. All right, Sean, let me just mention that another two managers went in Serie A since we last spoke. We said on Monday that dear old Sinisa Mihalovic was about to go. He did go. That day, Delio Rossi was appointed and was greeted by wildly cheering fans in Florence, who said, "We've been waiting for you, Delio." Plenty of fans in that city.
Were they Newcastle fans on an exchange?
Why?
Hailing the saviour.
Oh, right, okay. He said, "I'm not Padre Pio."
Right.
All right, which cleared up any confusion in that area. But anyway, Delio Rossi, a very good manager, and given to swimming in fountains after big wins. There you go. And also, and this was a surprise, a couple of days ago, Cagliari fired their second manager of the season. They had Roberto Donadoni at the start of the year. He started badly. They fired him. They brought in Massimo Ficcardenti, who'd impressed a lot of people with Cesena last year. They fired him this week. They brought in Davide Ballardini, who's only been there twice before. So, all very exciting. Oh, I should... lovely stat in La Repubblica. Cellino, who's the owner and president of Cagliari, he's been through 33 managers in 20 years. That's pretty good, isn't it? It's pretty good, but not as good as Maurizio Zamperini of Palermo, who's been through 35. And Zamperini also impressing this week. I don't know if you've seen, he sold Pastore to Paris Saint-Germain. And he's now involved in a massive court case because he says that he was effectively bullied into this deal and was kind of conned into it. And he's now lost out on all the money from it. And he's blaming. He made this extraordinary statement where he says that what it is that these lawyers, you get a lot of these in America, lawyers of usually Jewish extraction who hang around and they con people into doing things. Anyway, so there's a bit of a storm about that in Italy, too, where there are storms about one or two things at the moment as it happens. Speaking of storms, Newcastle. Thanks, Mike Ashley, because our moral compass was whizzing round after all this recent, is he actually doing a good job there? Is he a decent fellow? But now we can, you know which direction we're facing, which way the wind's blowing. A menace, is he? Or is it actually his right to rename the stadium, just as Arsenal have done, just as others have done?
Well, it's entirely his right, because he owns the club. And the problem for Newcastle fans who are outraged at the fact that he's changed the name of the club to the Stotty Caicodrome or whatever it is that they can no longer claim he doesn't know what he's doing, because that's what that used to be their howl. You know, he hasn't a clue what he's doing. He's proved he does know what he's doing, because Newcastle are third in the Premier League table with quite a good team of not particularly big name players. So, as usual, he can ignore them. And I think the problem for Newcastle fans is he doesn't seem to care two hoots what
James Wells saying, does Mike Ashley like being hated? Genuine question. Some people enjoy it. Also tweeting on this subject, Jonna Wills. Anybody know, that's you, isn't it, Jonathan Wilson, mm-hmm. with a rather pithy question. Does anybody know what St. James paid for the original naming rights? Another how do you say that word? Vets, furriers and pharmacists that he represents feeling narked. Yeah.
I saw that. What's a furrier?
A man who takes fur off animals and makes it into hats and coats.
Right.
And
right. See, I thought you meant farriers, but had a typo or hit the wrong button.
No.
I'd never heard
of
a furrier.
Do they use sacks in the procuring of these animals?
I would have thought they would have done, yeah. Because as Barry was explaining,
I think we've explained
claws,
that whole mystery. There we go.
Getting back to your earlier point, I should point out I've only had about 10 hours sleep over the 3 days, hence the yawn, not about Serie A.
Oh, okay, right.
But also...
Yawny-shawny.
But, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of bad sport names, mm-hmm. the Sports Direct Arena isn't as bad as the Jiffy Lube Live Arena in Washington, D.C. Jiffy Lube, and I'm sure there are other bad names out there. But, I think it's a great shame. It's obviously all this tradition, but it's not a surprise.
Well,
let's be honest.
It's obviously disgraceful in almost every respect. No, in every respect. But it actually, from a money-making point of view, it makes some kind of sense in that he takes the flak now for renaming it the Sports Direct Arena. Then in a year or two's time, he sells the rights, and whichever company comes in doesn't get the full brunt of fan fury, which he's now absorbing. So if he's prepared to be hated, if he's prepared to sacrifice 119 years of tradition, which he clearly is, then it does make... Yeah, it does make commercial sense.
It's not his tradition, is it? I mean, he wasn't a Newcastle fan growing up.
No, Cockney Matthew, isn't he?
Right.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah. So, in that sense...
But he's done this before, though. Wasn't it St James's Park with at Sport Arena or at Sport Arena?
SportsDirect.com at St James's Park.
He's done that before, you know, with SportsDirect.com
at
St James's
Park. That worked really well. Everybody called it that.
But what do newspapers are going to do? Because we obviously, when we do match reports, we put the name of the stadium in. So I assume...
Danger is you get banned if you don't. I mean, certainly I think broadcasters who've bought the rights, they have to use the official name.
I think what tends to happen is if clubs rename an existing ground, the name doesn't catch on. But if they sort of move down the road and rename their ground, then it does. Now, the sort of exception to that rule is the Aviva Stadium in Dublin, formerly Lansdowne Road, which certainly in newspaper reports and journalism it's referred to as the Aviva Stadium, and I've heard a lot of people in Ireland refer to it as the Aviva Stadium. I personally would always call it Lansdowne Road.
But that's a stadium that, when you're there, it feels very different to Lansdowne Road. You don't sit there and think, yeah, this looks like Lansdowne Road. It feels like somewhere new because it is so radically different.
But I think at home now they're now referring to it as the Dole Bowl because Aviva recently laid off a load of staff in Ireland. Huh. But it's good that they're able to sponsor it.
How did the FA ever miss out on renaming Wembley when they redid it?
Well, presumably because people valued what would at the time been 84 years of tradition.
Perhaps. All right, here's a book I'm looking forward to reading. Nobody Ever Says Thank You. Nothing less than an extraordinary expose about hard-drinking, football-loving, European Cup-winning, managerial genius Brian Clough. Yes. By Jonathan Wilson. And when's it out, Jonathan?
Today.
No.
Although apparently...
Did you bring any with you?
No, I didn't. I've only been sent one copy.
Free books. He's so tight.
Apparently you could get it in the Watsons in Romford yesterday. They seem to have jumped
midnight,
the gun.
Did they?
No? So the two right, big launches this week were Modern Warfare, Call of Duty, and yep. Jonathan's book.
Which is more heavily discounted? I mean, Call of Duty you can get it for about £30 off the recommended retail price.
Can you?
Yeah.
Mm, I was going for £11 something, mine, I think, on Amazon.
£11?
I'm intrigued by the title. Why that title?
Because Harry Storer, who was an old Derby manager, and he coached Peter Taylor at Coventry and was very much Clough's mentor early on, he told him one of the first meetings, be aware, football is a game which nobody ever says thank you. And I think Clough really found that out when Sunderland sacked him as youth team coach after he'd taken him to the semi-final of the FA Youth Cup, basically because they wanted the insurance money to buy another centre-forward, Clough's career having come to an end with his knee injury. And you know, he felt very bitter, with I think some justification towards the Sunderland board, and probably felt then that the game owed him a living. And that might have been used to justify, at least in his own mind, some of what he got to later on.
There's been loads of fantastic books on Clough over the last 5 years, and they've Pierce's book, Provided You Don't Kiss Me, etc. and so on. What makes your book different?
It's a full biography. It goes right from birth to death. I mean, there have been a lot. I mean, probably more about Clough than anybody else. Very, very good books. But they're all memoirs. There hasn't been a proper biography since Tony Francis's in 1987. And obviously the fact, he had six more years of Clough at Forest, then the whole Bungs inquiry. And the fact Clough's dead now means you can perhaps take a...
You can libel the shit out of him.
That's exactly what I can do, yeah. But so there's far more...
The things about his alien abduction and all that stuff.
Well, amazing, Jonathan. That sounds brilliant. Nobody Ever Says Thank You out right now. What's your next book going to be on?
On goalkeepers. It's called The Outsider, and it should be out next year.
No way. Cool. Excellent. All right. Well, very good. That brings us to the end of today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to Jonathan Wilson, Sean Inglam, Barry Glendinning, and guest producer Pascal. And we'll be back on Monday. Before that, as ever, Friday morning brings a roundup of the European papers. Might be a little something on Modgy in there. And do join me for that if you like. Otherwise, have a super weekend, and we'll speak to you on Monday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.